Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly recap of Utah news by the Salt Lake Tribune. This week on the program, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals weighs in on same-sex marriage, ruling against Utah's Amendment 3. What does the ruling mean for the 1,000 or so same-sex couples who married here in December? The LDS Church excommunicates Kate Kelly of Ordained Women. How are Mormons across the religious spectrum taking the news? And a Salt Lake City police officer looking for a missing child kills a dog in a fenced backyard. Thousands are rallying online and in person, demanding justice for the dog named Geist. How will Chief Burbank respond? All that in Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we've got gay rights, we've got apostasy, a dog shooting, and much more. And joining me this morning is Tribune editorial writer George Pyle. George, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, reporter Kristen Moulton. Kristen, hi.
Good morning.
Government reporter Matt Canham is also with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And making her Behind the Headlines debut, justice reporter Jessica Miller. Jessica, hi.
Hello.
And you can join us, too, if there's a news story that's on your mind, something that's been eating at you and want to talk about it. You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put your comments on our website at sltrib.com. Or, of course, you can call us live. We're here at KCPW. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Lots of big headlines this week, but I guess the biggest one, the 10th Circuit decision. This week, the long-awaited 10th Circuit Court of Appeals issued its ruling. It was another blow to Utah's ban on gay marriage. And Jessica, you've been covering this. Give us a basic outline of the court's ruling.
Okay, the 10th Circuit ruled that states outlawing same-sex marriage are violating citizens' rights, and specifically their 14th Amendment right, which gives equal protection to American citizens. It was a 2-1 split, meaning that one judge did disagree. He issued a dissenting opinion. The court did immediately issue a stay, though, in the decision. They anticipated that Utah will appeal to the Supreme Court. The Attorney General's office and the governor both said they plan to do that.
Okay. This supports an earlier decision upholding federal district court judges Robert Shelby's decision. Did the 10th Circuit decision use some of Shelby's arguments in their ruling?
Yeah, they did agree in some aspects there. Interestingly, the judges ruled a lot. In the majority opinion, they really tore down the state's arguments about how same-sex marriage affects children and procreation. They said repeatedly that those arguments kind of failed because opposite-sex couples who do not or cannot have children are still allowed to marry, so that was kind of significant. And they basically said that their reading of the Constitution shows that the legal rights of married couples have nothing to do with the gender of whoever's in that union.
Mm-hmm. And significantly, they called marriage a fundamental right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the 10th Circuit ruling, even though it's strongly worded, it really has no practical effect on those 1,000 or so couples that got married here in Utah back in December because they issued a stay, as you mentioned. What does
right.
that mean, and why did they do it?
So basically, at this point, the stay meaning they basically just pushed pause on this ruling to allow the state to appeal to the Supreme Court. Basically, the state has two options, two routes where they can go from here. They can either ask the Supreme Court to hear the case, or in the meantime, they ask for the 10th Circuit to rehear the case in front of a full panel of judges where this ruling was just in front of three.
Mm-hmm.
The state officials have said they do plan to go to the Supreme Court with the case, but they haven't decided yet whether they want the rehearing. And that's kind of the Supreme Court is kind of the final stop. So issuing the stay kind of puts this on hold until this final decision and the last ruling is kind of put into place.
Okay. Interestingly, you mentioned this was not a unanimous decision. Mm-hmm. It was a split 2-1 vote. What were the arguments presented in the dissenting opinion?
So Judge Paul Kelly who wrote the dissenting opinion. He said that he didn't believe the 14th Amendment required Utah to extend marriage to same-sex couples. He said the Constitution is silent on the regulation of marriage and that the power should be reserved just for the states to decide. And where the two judges attacked the state's assertions that the same-sex marriage affects couples and procreation, Judge Kelly kind of countered that, and he argued that the state should be able to consider procreation when regulating marriage laws.
Hmm. Swift, strong, vocal reaction. Gay community, and I understand there was a rally Wednesday night?
Yep, yeah. The plaintiff's attorneys, as you imagine, were really ecstatic. They're very happy, very overjoyed. There were rallies on Wednesday. Several hundred people came to support. There was a rally yesterday, last night, for more of the traditional marriage supporters. From what I've heard, a lot of has basically said they've been disappointed, but that they also are glad that they reached this stage, and now they're looking forward to the Supreme Court, where it's kind of the final opinion.
Mm-hmm. What about the political sector? And Matt, I know you did some coverage on this. The governor weighed in. What did he say?
The governor weighed in and said that he was disappointed. And it was pretty measured response from the political community. In a sense, they expected this ruling in many ways. So they're looking at this as an intermediary step between what Judge Shelby did and what the Supreme Court may do. So they're just hunkering down and looking at what the next option is and if there's a way to fine-tune their argument before they go to the high court.
Mm-hmm. Senator Orrin Hatch, he had earlier predicted that the gay marriage debate is over, so I guess no surprise. It was just another stepping stone on the path to the Supreme Court for him.
Yeah, over the last few years, politically, gay marriage is not the hot-button issue it was back in, say, 2006. Even supporters of traditional marriage have not made it such a cornerstone issue, in part because, especially in the last year, court after court after court has ruled that gay marriage should be legal or that gay marriage bans, are not constitutional. And even when the Tenth Circuit ruled the other day, so did a federal judge in Indiana strike down their gay marriage ban. So there's been a lot of rulings all trending in one direction.
Mm-hmm. George Pyle, we've talked about gay marriage before. Your editorial this week opines that the court decision is really just a reflection of reality. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned in the editorial that a lot of times when especially conservatives, well, liberals are sometimes heard to say this too, when they don't like a judicial ruling, especially on the appellate level, they complain about judicial activism, that the judges are pulling us in some direction that we don't want to go, that they're into the undiscovered country and ignoring democracy and culture. But it really seems in the past, the way the polls have gone, especially the way the polls show, you know, when you poll people like under 30, you know, do you support gay marriage? It's like 72% support. All the trends, all the courts that have ruled on this recently have said this is a fundamental right. The 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection of the laws. And the most important judge in the universe, Anthony Kennedy, has said that when you don't allow gay families or families headed by same-sex couples to marry and get all the rights and responsibilities of marriage, you are actively and illegally discriminating against them and, more importantly, against their children. They do have children. I mean, the argument that the state raises is marriage is about procreation and raising children. That's for opposite-sex couples. And the courts are saying, no, it's not. It's for same-sex couples, too. Look around. And so what the courts are saying, they're not leading us ahead. They're not dragging us someplace we don't want to go. They're looking around and looking at life on Earth and saying, this is the way life is. And to go for a state to go out of its way to invalidate these unions is unconstitutional and mean, too.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, does the governor, does the attorney general, do they actually have a choice? Was there a win scenario for them?
Well, I mean, they, as we've said, they are happy that we're through this stage now. We'll go to the Supreme Court and get it resolved. And if it goes to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court says, no, you have to allow gay marriage, then the governor and the attorney general can say, well, look, we did our best, but the Supreme Court has ruled and we have to abide by that. The governor was saying that yesterday. He said, I'm defending Utah's law. If Utah's law said same-sex marriage is legal, I'd defend that too.
Okay. Matt, do you have a comment?
No, I was just going to reiterate what he said. The way that the governor is responding to this is by trying to take the politics out of it and say he's just following the rule of law. Now, at the same time, obviously the majority of people in his party in the state probably would hope that he would fight this law to the end. And so, you know, there's that little rub politically. But it also shows, as I said before, that Republicans are not making this the hot button issue as before. The governor is not saying this because it's morally right. He's crafting it as saying, I'm defending a law that was put on the books.
And interestingly, I've heard some arguments from gay activists who say, thank you, Governor Herbert, because you're pushing us toward an ultimate solution. So at first he was vilified. Now I think some people are saying, well, good on you, because we need an answer in this.
Well, yeah, if the district court had ruled same-sex marriage was legal and the state didn't appeal it, it would only be legal by that decision in Utah. You need other actions to make it legal other places. If the Tenth Circuit says it's illegal, that same-sex marriage has to be allowed in the Tenth Circuit, the six states of the Tenth Circuit, then, and we drop it, Utah drops it, then you only have to allow it in the Tenth Circuit. If you take it to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court says you have to allow same-sex marriage, then you have to allow same-sex marriage in the whole country from a seed that was germinated in Utah. So some people in Utah are saying, yeah, this is our Brown versus the board, and we're proud of it.
Jessica, of course, the Utah Attorney General's office is defending Amendment 3. Have they showed their hand? Are they going to appeal to the en banc, the full Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals? Are they going to go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court? When do they have to do this?
They have 90 days to, as far as what I understand, they have 90 days to kind of make that decision whether to go to the Supreme Court. They have said that they do plan to do that. Last we'd heard, I think it was Wednesday was the last time they made a statement. And at that time, they said they hadn't decided yet on whether to try to go for the full court review with the Tenth Circuit Court.
In their statement, did they see any silver lining to the Tenth Circuit, anything that would support their case?
If they did, they didn't say it. But basically, they said that they're disappointed, but they were glad that it's gone to this point, and now they can appeal to the higher court. So they're just happy that there was a decision at this time.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, we have 1,000 or so couples, George, who are still waiting.
Who are still waiting. Some of them are trying to adopt the children that they're already raising, that they are already de facto the parents of, but the state won't let them adopt. And, I mean, it's back and forth, and you read the majority ruling and the dissent, and you listen to the people on both sides of the issue, and they're all standing up and saying, we're doing this for the children, to coin a cliche. And in this case, with the Windsor decision at the Supreme Court, with the Tenth Circuit, they're saying, yes, we do care about the children. And so if you care about the children, you care about the children who already live in households headed by same-sex couples, and you have to give them equal protection of the laws.
Mm. Matt, there's a money angle to this. The state of Utah, taxpayers are funding the state's defense of Amendment 3. Do we have a tally? Do we have a sense of how much this is costing us?
Well, we're now into the millions, but the state and the attorney general and the governor's office have tried to deflect any tension based off of the money that's going in. They're saying that they've built in these appeals into their budget. So they're trying to shift some money from other things as well to try to make it so there's not a political backlash for the amount of money it takes to defend a case like this that goes all the way to the Supreme Court or can go to the Supreme Court. They've also hired some outside attorneys because, you know, that's where the money comes in. The Attorney General's office can only handle so much. And in a case this complicated, they've gone outside.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the next step? We're waiting. We're waiting for the appeal. We're waiting for the Supreme Court. We're waiting, right,
yep.
Jessica?
Pretty much, that's it. Just waiting to see what kind of appeal they're going to do.
Okay. And meanwhile, George, the debate continues to rage across the country. How does Utah fit into the big picture?
Well, because we've gone through the appellate level and nobody else has, and we've got a decision at the appellate level and nobody else has, Utah is out front on this. I mean, you know, 5 years ago, would you have said, okay, what state is going to lead the country in finally resolving, probably in favor of same-sex marriage, this question? I don't think Utah is the one you would have picked, but that's the way it's going. And as you said, some people are on the gay rights side are looking at this and saying, hey, we're the ones that are going to push this over, just like Utah was the final state to ratify the repeal of prohibition, which you might not have thought otherwise. Harry Truman says he liked those Utahns. So.
Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer George Pyle is here along with reporters Kristen Moulton, Matt Canham, and Jessica Miller, and they're all in the house. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW, and you can join us as well. The number, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can also participate via Twitter. Send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune. And joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Jessica Miller, Kristen Moulton, and Matt Canham, along with editorial writer George Pyle. And you can join us. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, put your comments at sltrib.com, or call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's turn to a major figure in the headlines this week, Kate Kelly. On Sunday night, LDS church authorities were considering her case. She's the founder of Ordain Women, which is proposing to extend priesthood ordination to women. And Kristen Moulton, explain why Kate Kelly was in the crosshairs.
Well, Kate Kelly has she was the founder of an organization called Ordain Women. It's only been around a little over a year. And she and hundreds of other women and men throughout the country have been campaigning for the ordination, and not in a quiet way. They went twice. They walked several hundred people to the priesthood session during conference in October and again in April, asking for tickets to be able to get in. Of course, only the women asked for the tickets because only the women can't go into the priesthood session. They were turned down, but it was a very visible protest. And this last time in April, they had been asked not to do it, and they went ahead anyway. So the church saw that as, you know, a little bit of in-your-face activism.
Is that what got her in trouble? Was it her public profile, or was it something else? We talk about these grounds of apostasy, and maybe you can explain what that is in the Mormon context.
Yeah, to answer the first part of that question, the church contends it was very much the public pressure that, you know, in the letters her bishop has written her and whatnot, it's always about you're free to believe whatever you want, you just can't recruit others. You can't be public about it. And it's interesting that even though the letter that her bishop sent to her for the disciplinary council last Sunday evening back in Virginia said that she was being tried for apostasy, that isn't what they excommunicated her on.
Okay.
The grounds that they excommunicated her on was conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church. And that could signal several different things. It could be that the bishop's council was not unanimous on apostasy. And they have to be unanimous. There are three members of this bishop's council that tried her last Sunday evening. So that could be the reason. It could be that maybe they had advice from church leaders that you don't want to excommunicate her as an apostate because that gives her more of a martyr kind of gravitas that they didn't want her to have. That could be it, too. It's hard to know precisely what, but that wasn't the grounds that they excommunicated her on. And, you know, I'm not sure that I know the full definition of apostasy, except that it is somebody who teaches contrary to the doctrine of the church.
The reason this made headlines is because it's quite rare, right? I mean,
well,
people who are excommunicated maybe for other kinds of church leaders consider to be sins, behavioral sins, but intellectual reasons, it's not common.
Right. It's not that common. I think it probably happens a lot more than any of us know because it's entirely private unless the party goes public, which, of course, Kate did. So it probably happens more than we know, but most often people are excommunicated for adultery, for fraud. And, of course, the church sees their excommunication process as the first step toward healing. You know, their whole goal is to bring people back into full communion with the church. And, of course, there are a lot of people now arguing on the Bloggernacle that, you know, this is an example of how the church discipline system is not set up for people who disagree on doctrine. It's set up for the adulterers and the fraudsters and that sort of thing. It's not set up. It's set up for the people who are sorrowful for what the church sees as sins. It's not set up for people who disagree about what they can say publicly.
You mentioned the hearing was held in Virginia on Sunday night, and there was a little bit of drama because they didn't give their decision right away. And then they issued their decision on Monday or made that public. How did Kate Kelly react to that?
She was stunned. She said that she was believing to the very end that she would be not excommunicated. She perhaps thought she would be disfellowshipped, which is a lesser punishment. You still remain a member of the church when you are disfellowshipped. But she was stunned. And I think within a few hours, she was angry.
She did not attend the disciplinary court. She's living here in Utah. The court was held in Virginia. Why? Why did she say she did not go?
She said she didn't go because she objected to the fact that her former bishop and stake president were holding on to the disciplining process, that they didn't move her records to Provo, where she's now living, or at least living for the summer. She had asked her in early May at about the same time they had started the ball rolling on disciplining her. And she just thought it unfair that they didn't let her new bishop handle it.
Mm-hmm. Reaction, as you mentioned, on the blogger knackle, which is the blogosphere for Mormon country, was pretty swift. What were some of the feelings out there? Is there fear? Is there anxiety, sorrow?
You know, I haven't seen much fear expressed publicly, but there has to be quite a bit of it. And I know even in the ordained women movement, there is some. I spoke to one woman last week. We were going to do an interview. She had had some informal discipline against her, but nothing formal yet. And she agreed to talk to me. But as it got closer to the interview, she backed farther out. She just didn't want to speak at all, even anonymously. So I know there is that fear. They're not being too public about it. But what you're seeing on the blogger knackle is sort of this increasing polarization that's happening among Mormons who pontificate online, and also within the feminist Mormon movement, because there are many Mormon feminists who do not support the ordained women movement. So you see a lot of polarization happening. In ordained women itself, it's interesting. They say that they have 170 new profiles submitted to their website since her apostasy hearing was scheduled. And these profiles are people who are willing to put their first names and their photos out there on the website saying we support the ordination of women. So they're people who are willing to go public, if not with their full names, at least with their photos. So they've lost 5 profiles and gained 170. So I think the polarization is growing. You can tell it's growing.
Mm-hmm. George, what's your assessment? What's your take on all of this? Does it continue to fester? Or now that Kate Kelly is out of the official church membership, will she lose some influence?
Well, the Washington Post has this smart aleck thing they do called Who Had the Worst Week in Washington? Who had the worst week in Utah? The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They lost the Tenth Circuit on the gay marriage thing that we talked about earlier. And to an outsider who observes these events, they look really bad. They make it look like they can't handle internal dissent. They have a bunch of men sitting in judgment on what a woman is saying and asking. It becomes obvious that, you know, the point of a religion is to speak truth to power, and you can't speak truth to power if you are power. They just look awful. And as I said before, and as somebody else said on the comment board, quoting another great feminist, the more you tighten your grip, the more systems will slip through your fingers. And I think that, you know, they said more women are standing up and saying, no, this is wrong. And they're saying, you know, even if we come to the end of the day in this round and you don't ordain women, the least you can do is talk to people, listen to people, understand that they're making a plea. They want to stay in the church. They're not going off and starting their own church, which many times has happened. They want to stay in the church. They were raised in the church. They were raising their children in the church. They've done everything in the church, and they just think the church isn't meeting their needs, and they want to tell them that. And the church isn't listening. And they just look awful.
A comment on sltrib.com from Reality: Reordain Women should have been the title of the women's group. Krista Moulton, yeah.
You know, I think it will be interesting to see what happens going forward, but there are so many women that I have run across lately who never would have been galvanized to put themselves out there, but who are now emboldened by ordained women. Women at the vigil the night that the disciplinary council was happening in Virginia, there was a vigil here in Salt Lake in front of the church office building, and I met a young woman who was carrying her baby, and she has a 7-year-old girl. She is the perfect, you know, beautiful young Mormon woman who has a young family. And she was there to tell, and she said, I won't take my 7-year-old daughter to church anymore. Hmm. We don't go because I don't want her raised in a culture that I was raised in, where she felt that she was raised to be a mom and a wife, and she's happy in those roles, and yet those were the only roles that she felt were available to her growing up. And she would have at one time had dreamt of being a lawyer, had dreamt of being on the stage and all these other things. And though she doesn't resent where she is now, she also really, really resents the culture as much as anything that she sees as patriarchal. And she had had, she didn't go to the two previous Ordained Women actions. She just showed up there that night. And you could, her anger was palpable. And she didn't look like the kind of person you would expect to find there.
Strong feelings.
So I think that, you know, if there are many of those women, I'm not sure there are, but I think there are a fair number. I think the church is going to have some reckoning to do.
You got some splaining to do.
And on the other side, I mean, the blogosphere has plenty of strong statements saying women don't need the priesthood. Maybe some places in the church, maybe some tweaking of policies and leadership, but we don't need priesthood ordination. Here's a comment on a Twitter from Fringe. The church history library is collecting people's blog posts. Exciting for future historians. So clearly, this week's episode will have a lot of implications as we go forward. What's next for Kate Kelly, Kristen?
She told me that she doesn't intend to do what the excommunication letter said, which is, you know, repent and take down the Ordained website. And, you know, I mean, all those were in a previous letter. But if you start behaving, you can come back into the church. She said, I'm not going to start doing what they ask. So she's not looking for rebaptism in the church. She said she'll come back if and when they ordain women. So
a really interesting story. Again, something that we will continue to follow, of course. I want to move on to another story that made a lot of people really angry. A Salt Lake City man gets this really tragic phone call from the Salt Lake City police last week concerning his dog. Refresh our memories, Jessica. What happened?
All right. Well, basically, last Wednesday, police were looking for a missing 3-year-old child. And in the process
this
of that.
This is in Sugar House, right?
Yes. An officer went into Sean Kendall's backyard. He has a 110-pound Weimaraner named Geist. And according to police, the dog approached him in what he deemed an aggressive manner. So the dog, or the officer, shot and killed the dog. And at that point, animal control was called. They're the ones who called. Sean Kendall basically said, come home, your dog's been shot. They didn't really tell him anything more than that, so he didn't know, like, if he had got out, did he attack anyone, just that police shot him and he's dead.
Okay, the really interesting story, an element of the story came out yesterday. He actually videotaped that encounter with police. Jessica, describe for those who have not seen it, what was on this video clip?
Well, it kind of starts with him, you know, driving to his house. He's got the camera facing him, and he says, you know, I've just been told that police shot and killed my dog. Like, what were they doing? What's going on? And so he gets there, and the police, they kind of give him information, but it's very basic. It's just an officer went in the backyard looking for a missing child, and then they shot your dog. And that's pretty much all they say, and he keeps asking them. And as this video goes on, he gets more and more angry and upset. And, you know, why was he in my backyard? Why would he go on my property? Why didn't he just back out and close the gate? And the officers who were there, the officer who shot the dog wasn't there. But the officers who were there, you know, are trying to remain kind of neutral, be sympathetic, but they're not really giving him a lot of answers either. They're trying to get information from him, like your phone number, what's your name. And he's kind of being a little abrasive too, because, you know, he just found out his dog was shot.
Sure.
And so he kind of talks with them. He gets really upset. I think at some point, like, he drops the camera, and towards the end he picks it back up, and he shows you the backyard. You know, there's this tall, like, 6-foot fence where you would imagine that a 3-year-old child who was lost probably would not be able to get into the yard. And he shows, you know, this is where my fence is. This is where my dog is at. The dog's still laying in the backyard. And this is how much distance was between. And so what happened here that the officer felt the need that this was the action that should have been taken?
If you have not seen this video, go to sltrib.com. It's pretty telling. He turns his rage, like any self-respecting 20-something would do, into online activism. He creates this Facebook page, huge amount of response. He's organized a rally that is happening tomorrow at 10 a.m. the reaction is quite quite vocal. And what does he want? Salt Lake City Police. What does he want from Salt Lake City?
Well, he met with Salt Lake City Police earlier this week, and I guess the point of the meeting, I guess, was just to kind of talk. I don't know what happened during that meeting, but afterwards he came out and talked to reporters, and he basically said, "I'm not going to be satisfied until this officer's fired." Mm-hmm. So that's what he sees. He'd mentioned that, you know, that the police kind of view his dog as property. So I don't know if there was talks as far as like, okay, you know, a purebred Weimaraner costs, you know, X amount of dollars. Do we give him money? I don't know if that's what was going on, but he basically says he's not satisfied unless this officer is gone from the force.
And I understand that he also wants training. He wants the cops to be trained in a more appropriate way, how they encounter animals that may appear to be threatening. Salt Lake City Council has sent a letter to Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank asking for answers. Where is Burbank on this?
Well, last week, you know, really, the police have released very little about this incident besides the basics of what has occurred. They have not released anything. They haven't released who this officer was. They've been kind of quiet about the whole thing. But earlier in this week, right after they had met with the dog owner, they did say that they don't have specific training on how to deal with dogs or aggressive dogs, you know, how to deal with that in their function as police officers. And so that's something that they might be looking at in the future because of this incident.
Hmm. George, it's interesting because this is not an isolated incident. These police shooting dogs happens a lot across the country.
Yeah, well, it's happening more and more. People are more and more worried about what they call the militarization of the police, SWAT raids on houses with marijuana plants, sometimes the wrong house. The former attorney general was complaining about that the other day. And the question of, you know, is there a protocol? I mean, police have all these lawyers breathing down their neck all the time, their own and the other guys. And everything's got protocols and standards and training, and to the point where, you know, police officers tell you they spend more time in class than they do on the streets. And it's kind of surprising to find out that they don't seem to have a protocol. What do you do when you're approached by a dog who hasn't actually attacked or bitten anybody yet but is acting in a threatening manner? You know, is pulling the revolver the first step? Well, the Humane Society says no, there are ways to deal with this, and the police ought to be trained in this. And, you know, we at the Tribune, at the editorial page, we've been singing the praises of our police department for a long time. Chief Burbank was Utah of the Year a couple of years ago. He was one of the few police chiefs who quietly and peacefully broke up the Occupy camp, whereas police in other towns went in with batons and shields. And he rightfully was very proud of that. But now we have this. We have the incident of the high-ranking officer who was in trouble for having inappropriate photographs of subordinates. Female subordinates on his cell phone, and instead of being instantly fired, he was allowed to hang on long enough to retire and get his full benefits. These two things coming together kind of undermine and the rape kits not being analyzed
processed.
And just left on the shelf for such a long time is undermining what had been a very good public image for the Salt Lake City Police Department.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it seems that the outrage is geared in two ways. One is the dog itself, you know, killing a dog. The other is invasion on private property.
Yeah, they were saying, you know, they're looking for a missing child who was later found in his own basement, I guess, not that long later. And, you know, why are you looking there? Why are you looking in a place with a huge fence? But I do remember several years ago, a child went missing, and they didn't find her for a long time. Finally, they found out that she'd been attacked and murdered by somebody who lived three doors down, and her body had been there for days and days while they were looking. So I think maybe you need to cut the police a little slack when a child is missing and everybody's adrenaline is through the roof, and you're going to do everything you can to look really fast, because when in a missing person's case, especially a missing child case, you know, if you don't find them in about the first couple of hours, you know, the chances of finding them at all really plummet. Mm. So the fact that he was in there, you know, just personally not having been there, I would think maybe you would want to cut him a little slack. But again, some kind of training and protocol for what to do, especially when you're in the dog's territory. Dogs are naturally territorial. That's why people have dogs, is to protect their property. He went into the dog's backyard, I mean, not the person's backyard, the dog's backyard, and was confronted by a dog saying, "Hey, what are you doing here? Dogs don't recognize police uniforms or badges or Miranda warnings. They say, I'm a dog, this is my territory, I'm going to growl at you until you leave, and I might bite you too." And you would think that police officers in this modern age, with all the training and everything that they and legal requirements that they have, would have more training in what to do and maybe not shoot first and ask questions later.
Mm. It's interesting. Sean Kendall says that 1,000 people, at least 1,000 people, are expected to come to this rally at the Salt Lake City Police Department. I guess we'll see what happens. Certainly a story that the Salt Lake Tribune will continue to follow. Before we get to a break, I want to talk politics a little bit. Governor Herbert inadvertently showed his political hand at a breakfast meeting this week. Matt Canham, what did he let slip?
So he brought together a who's who of Utah's political elite, business leaders, power brokers, their lobbyists, and he said privately at a breakfast on Wednesday at the New Yorker that he was going to run again and he wants them to stay on his team. And those people in that private meeting went out and called Robert Gerke.
Of course they did. Who else are you going to talk to?
A number of them called Robert Gerke. This is not one source. This is not two sources. This is a few sources. And you can go on the Salt Lake Tribune and read Robert Gerke's story. But essentially, they all said the same thing, that the governor said unequivocally he is running for re-election in 2016. Now, why did the governor feel the need to do this? Is because other people are interested in running in 2016, and he wants to make sure that these power brokers stay on his team. The governor's worried about two people in particular. There's House Speaker Becky Lockhart, mm-hmm. who has been rumored to be running and has taken some jabs at the governor for quite some time. There's also, more quietly, Overstock.com President Jonathan Johnson. He has been making the rounds at Republican meetings. He's been talking to people and saying, I'm going to run whether Governor Herbert runs or not. And he's been trying to quietly cobble together a team. So this is the governor trying to protect his turf. You know, some people are rolling their eyes at this because it's 2014.
Right.
We have an election this November, and
right.
he's worried about election in 2016. This shows you what stage politics has become in this country. It never stops.
He's super popular, at least on the recent poll numbers that I've seen.
Yeah. I mean, the last poll that we've seen had his favorability rating at 68%.
Mm.
But that's with the state as a whole. And when you get into a primary situation, a showdown between two people, those numbers can change. So this is a sign that he is worried that he could have defectors from his team to go to someone else. Also, there's always a question when he's a two-term governor running for a third term, is he going to run again or not is a big question. We've seen that in the past as well.
Mm-hmm. Governor has been vilified, also celebrated by an element of gay rights activists on his decision to stand behind Amendment 3. He's had several quite public standoffs with House Speaker Becky Lockhart. Again, very early days, but George Pyle, can the governor maintain his popularity and clinch another term? And that third term is tenuous.
Yeah, a lot of people think, you know, three is too many. Now, he's in a little bit of a weird situation because he took over for John Huntsman when John Huntsman went off to be ambassador to China. So then he had to run for re-election because it was more than half a term. And then he ran for re-election again. And there's always the question of, you know, does anybody, even if they're popular, do you get tired of somebody after a while? And do you want to go on to somebody else? And as Matt said, this is the permanent campaign. And he can't afford to wait until even after this year's election is over to start raising money, lining up county chairmen, lining up donors. And it just kind of goes to show you that, you know, what the people of Utah think isn't really that important. It's what the donors and the activists and the money raisers think. And he's got the gay marriage thing, which may by 2016 be old news already.
Sure.
He is feuding with the legislature over his unique, sort of unique Utah plan on how to expand Medicaid, which he sees as a conservative market-based Utah solution, and which Becky Lockhart and others see as Obamacare in disguise, and they're going to fight it all the way. He's won a lot of support from the business community, which is where the money is, for his version of Medicaid expansion. So that's a place where he's gaining support from people who matter.
Mm.
We have, you know, the Count My Vote movement and the fact that primaries are now a little bit more open than they used to be. It is not totally dependent on the caucus convention system. That might open up the process a little bit so the governor doesn't have to worry quite so much about being Tea Partied the way Eric Cantor was in Virginia a couple
sure,
of weeks ago.
Sure. We've got about a minute before we need to head to a break. Matt, can you just give us, maybe people missed it. It was primary election day this week on Tuesday. Any notable results? Anything people need to know?
We have the return of Brad Daugh. Brad Daugh is an Orem former legislator who lost his election because he was vilified in attack ads for trying to rein in payday lenders. The payday lenders just hit him on every issue they could, and that was in part fueled by former Attorney General John Swaller, who's under investigation for some allegations of misdeeds on his own. So Brad Daugh has started, he came back riding that publicity involving John Swaller's campaign and beat the person who beat him, which is Representative Dana Layton. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest race in the primary. There were a couple other minor ones that in southern Utah where people who supported the Count My Vote, the change in our election system, were challenged from the right, and they both won handily.
Okay. Onward to November. We're talking about the week's news. We invite you to chime in as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We've got another little break here. We'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And in studio, we've got Kristen Moulton, Jessica Miller, Matt Canham, and George Pyle, all from the Salt Lake Tribune. And you can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number, or send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. One story that caught a lot of buzz this week, a group of over-enthusiastic LDS missionaries making their mark on Mount Olympus. And Kristen, only a couple of minutes on this story, but generally what happened?
Well, hikers up Mount Olympus last weekend found a flagpole in concrete on the top of the summit with a U.S. flag and a t-shirt flying, and it had the logo, or it was printed with the words Salt Lake City East Mission and the autographs of eight missionaries.
Okay, so this caused some controversy because Mount Olympus is
in a wilderness area.
In a wilderness area. U.S. Forest Service, not happy.
Not happy. Within a day or two, somebody else took the flags down. Yesterday, a hiker said when he got there, the pole had been knocked down too. It looked like it had been bent down at its base. And the LDS Church said that their attorney has talked to the Forest Service and the missionaries will be going up to remove the concrete.
Apologies?
Nobody's mentioned an apology, nor have they mentioned any kind of punishment. The Forest Service District Ranger said that as long as they take care of it, there should be no problem. And it's not the first time. You know,
sure.
We can say this is stupid that they did this, but even law enforcement officers who were adults went to King's Peak, the highest peak in Utah, 10 years ago, and put up a plaque to a fallen one of their colleagues who had died in Iraq. So, you know, even more mature and people in law enforcement make the mistake of thinking that you can just do whatever you want in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. A story we'll continue to follow again. Time for our underplayed story of the week, the story that may have gone under the radar because this was a really heavy, big headline kind of week. George Pyle, what's your pick?
Well, it made the back page, even though it was pretty important. The letter from a lot of Republican politicians, including sitting members of the legislature, urging Congress to actually do immigration reform. The next day, there was a story in the Washington Post that said immigration reform is dead as long as Obama's president. So maybe that's why it was underplayed.
Immigration reform. Hopefully that'll be overplayed at some point. Matt Canham, what's your pick?
Demographics. The census came out with a report this week that shows that 1 in 5 Utahns is a minority. This is the first time we've ever hit this threshold, and it means a lot for the state and its future. How we integrate these people who are new to the state, how we are not as monolithic as we might believe ourselves to be. This is a change that will probably get more and more diverse as the time goes on.
Mm-hmm. The one element that I thought was pretty interesting about this story, reported by our colleague Lee Davidson, 50% of Utahns are male.
Yes, the one of only 10 states where that's true.
Yeah.
And the reason given is that we're one of the younger states. The reason that most states are predominant or have a majority of women is that women live longer. So the states where you have an older population, you have more women.
And we are not quite as young as we used to be. The median age, up to 30.
Yes, which is a full year more than it used to be, than it was in 2010, which also shows that, you know, young Utahns are not having as many kids as they used to.
Uh-huh. And the largest segment of the minority population?
Is Hispanic, about 14%. After that, you have Asians, American Indians, and then Black Americans at 2%.
A pretty interesting story. Kristen Moulton, what's your pick for the underplayed story of the week?
Well, it looks like Utah will have the very first tar sands oil mine in the country. The Supreme Court this week refused to hear a case or hear the argument. The argument against it from Living Waters. The court said that they had filed their objection too late, so they're not even going to hear the case. The company that claims that it's going to use a very environmentally friendly process, unlike has been used in Alberta, they say that they're ready to go ahead soon, this summer.
So what exactly is tar sands development, for those who may not know?
You know, I'm not the best person to tell you this. I don't quite understand it. It's a different kind of oil, very thick, dense, heavy. It's been problematic in Canada, but I don't know the detail. Maybe George knows more about tar sands.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the question is, does anybody really know about tar sands? And is there really an environmentally friendly way of pulling it out of the rocks? People have been saying for years, oh, we're the Saudi Arabia of tar sands. We can power the world on this forever. That is dependent on the idea that you can actually extract it from the rocks without using tons of water that we don't have, without polluting the water that we do have, and actually find a way to refine it. There are a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, we got this piece of cake. And there are other people who say there's absolutely no way. And in this case, it was a procedural thing. Nobody ruled on the merits of whether or not you can actually do this in a way that doesn't leave a gaping wound like they have in Alberta.
Mm, right. Mm-hmm. And just as an aside to this, there are several groups camping out near the site. They're on BLM land, but they are protesting it all summer. They have actions planned. I think it's called tarsandsresistance.com. They have actions this weekend, one last weekend. They're Peaceful Uprising is helping them with it. Anyway, they are objecting, camping nearby, and claiming that the groundwater would be very much damaged.
Mm, that is a story we will continue to follow. Jessica, what's your pick?
Well, I'm starting to follow a court case this week about a woman. Her nickname is Hitler.
Hitler?
She is staying up at the Rainbow Gathering up in Heber. She was charged this week with attempted murder after she allegedly stabbed a man at this Peace and Love gathering. Police say...
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing, but that's so ironic.
Right. Police say that apparently this altercation happened after the man, the victim, had confronted her. She'd been allegedly honking her car horn for about a half hour, and he was just fed up, and somehow this confrontation...
The peace and love went out the window.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's going to happen to Hitler?
She had her first court appearance this week. I'm not sure if they set the next one. Apparently, she might be facing more charges. There might be another assault with a tire iron or something. I'm not sure. We'll see where she ends up.
That is an interesting story. Peace and love. Okay. My pick for the underplayed story is by our colleague Kirsten Stewart, who wrote about the influence and the appearance of doctors in our state legislature. Interestingly, if this particular candidate wins, there will be more doctors or healthcare professionals than attorneys in the state legislature, which I think is quite a turn.
As we fight out Medicaid, that's going to be very important.
Indeed. Thank you all very much for all of your insights. Matt Canham, Kristen Moulton, Jessica Miller, and of course, George Pyle. Thanks a lot, guys.
You're welcome.
And we're going to wrap up today's program with a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, who has vacation on the mind.
Have you ever taken a vacation where it's more work to go on vacation than it is to just stay home and keep working?
Well, you need a vacation from those kinds of vacations, for sure.
Right, yeah. And that was sort of like it. You know, it never had I been more happy to get home than I was from a vacation I'd looked forward to for years.
You wrote a column about this in 2008.
Yes.
You want to read just a little bit of it?
Monday night, I fell asleep on the bathroom floor. baked ceramic tile is positively downy compared to the hotel beds we'd slept on for the past 2 weeks. I vaguely remember coming home from the airport exhausted and going in to brush my teeth. Then it was Tuesday and the cat was walking around on me. I must have gotten too close to the floor or something. I woke up long enough to crawl into a real bed. We're home from our European sojourn and recovering. Ironically, the 2 week, 20,000-mile getaway got us away from everything we needed to do that. We were even happier about coming home than we were about leaving in the first place. This follows the habit human beings have of overplanning things and trying to cram too much into too little time. And we did that. And by the time, 2 or 3 days before we're set to come home, we were almost willing to go down on the docks and stick our thumbs out to a passing fishing boat or something. Get us home. We don't care how much it costs.
I'm guessing that you don't want to vacation like this all the time.
No, I don't. And you're supposed to learn from every vacation you go on. We won't do that again. You know, we won't stay with Aunt Celia again. But you do. Somehow you get talked into it. And so we're planning another cruise, and this time we tell ourselves we're not going to do it. But what are the odds?
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. He joins us each week with the best from the archive, and you can find all of his columns on the website sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with support by Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. We're taking next week off for the 4th of July. We'll be back the following week with all your Utah news and analysis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Until next time.